elements like ruthenium and molybdenum, which are palladium's neighbors on the periodic table. Those prior results of Schoenbachler seem to predict that they would find when they looked for the palladium isotope. They expected similar amounts of palladium, but got a big surprise. In their paper, the team presents a new model to explain these results. The paper is titled The Origin of S-Process Isotope Heterogeneity in the Solar Protoplanetary Disk. It was published in the journal Nature Astronomy on December 19, 2019. The lead author is Matthias Hess. Their model shows that even though everything in our solar system was created from star stuff, one type of star contributed most to Earth. Red giants, or otherwise known as asymptotic giant branch stars. These are stars in the same mass range as our sun, which expand into red giants when they are depleted of their hydrogen. Our own sun will become one of these in about 4 or 5 billion years. As part of their end state, these stars synthesize elements in what's called the S process. The S process, or slow neutron capture process, creates elements like palladium and its neighbors on the periodic table, ruthenium and molybdenum. On an interesting note, the S process creates these elements with seeds of iron nuclei, which themselves are created in supernovae in previous generations of stars. Palladium is slightly more volatile than the other elements measured. As a result, less of it condenses into dust around these stars, and therefore there is less palladium from star dust in the meteorites we studied excess. There is a great abundance of material from red giants in Earth's makeup than there is in Mars or in asteroids like Vesta further out of our solar system. The outer regions contain more material from supernova, the team said, and they can explain why that is. Quote, when the planet formed, temperatures closer to the Earth were very high, Schoenbachler explained. Some of the dust grains were more unstable than others, including ones with icy crust. That type was destroyed in the inner solar system close to the sun, but star dust from red giants was more stable and resisted destruction. So it's more concentrated close to the sun. The authors say that the dust from supernova explosion is also prone to evaporate more quickly since it's smaller, so there's less of it in the inner solar system and on Earth. This allows us to explain why the Earth has the largest enrichment of star stuff from red giant stars compared to other bodies in the solar system, Schoenbachler said. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2 Jim. Okay, on to the next. This has not been a good year for amateur astronomers. Locally, our own Limark Astronomy Net folded its tent, and now a major manufacturer in this field is struggling to survive. Meade Instruments, a company familiar to any backyard astronomer who's drooled over their telescopes, has filed for bankruptcy. The company has fallen on hard times in recent years as they face increasing competition. Meade also recently lost a lawsuit which pushed them over the edge into bankruptcy. The company is based in Irvine, California, and was founded in 1972. They started out selling small refracting telescopes. They expanded into Newtonian reflectors and Schmidt-Cassegrain telescopes over the years, and now they sell telescope models worth upwards of $10,000 apiece. Meade is a subsidiary of a Chinese company called Ningbo Sunny Electronics Company. Ningbo purchased Meade in 2013. Another company, Orion Telescopes and Binoculars, filed an antitrust suit against Ningbo, claiming that Ningbo and Meade were part of a price-fixing scheme and that they tried to force competitors out of the market. Meade and their parent company lost their lawsuit, and a jury found Meade liable for $16.8 million. Meade has filed for bankruptcy, claiming that they have debts between $10 million and $50 million. Chapter 11 protection gives the company an opportunity to be sold or reorganized and restructure its debt. The goal is usually to keep the company alive and develop a plan to repay its creditors over time. Recently, it was reported that Meade will try to sell itself through a court-supervised sale process. According to Bloomberg Law, Meade has reached out to 410 Partners, a firm specializing in corporate restructuring, and challenged businesses, litigation, and other special situations. as they say on their website. Let me drop for a second. The exact future timeline for a meet is unclear, but on December 6th, they posted this brief statement on Facebook. Quote, as in recent news, Mead Instrument has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection reorganization on December 4th, 2019. Please be assured that we will continue to support our products, our customers, and our network of dealers throughout this process. Our customers will remain our highest priority. We thank you for your valued support and look forward to continuing the Mead name. End quote. Many people have a long experience with Mead Telescope, and the company has a long history of innovation. They seem to have lots of loyal customers. Whether these legal troubles spell the end for Mead is unknown at this time, but many of their customers are hoping that they will stay in business. If a new owner steps up, who knows how things might turn out. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes. Okay, on to the next, I guess. If anyone out there ever kept tropical fish, as I did, it was not uncommon to flood an aquarium with antibiotics like tetracycline or amoxicillin. It could be purchased at pet stores. Now, how safe this might be for human use, I had no clue at the time, but I assumed that if it were good enough to sell to sick humans, it would not be sold for your guppy. In another example of the strange times that we live in, a study has found evidence that some people are buying fish antibiotics online to use on themselves, presumably because they're cheaper than visiting the doctor to get a proper prescription. Researchers from the University of South Carolina examined online reviews from 24 websites selling 9 kinds of fish antibiotics. Out of nearly 2,300 reviews they looked at, 55 views, that's about 2.4%, seem to indicate that the customers were buying the product for human use. While these reviews were few and far between, they received more attention and positive likes from other users than typical reviews did. The team also found at least one retailer who assured customers that the antibiotics were fine to use in people in response to a question. The preliminary, not yet peer-reviewed research was presented recently at the Michigan. Why exactly these people turn to fish drugs? The author and his team noted that these antibiotics are much less regulated than those sold for people, livestock, and pets like cats and dogs. Cost-wise, they're likely cheaper than what you pay for the human version, out-of-pocket without insurance. In the study, for instance, they found a bottle of 30 capsules of 50 milligram amoxicillin sold for $8.99, while the same quantity might run as high as $32 at your local Rite Aid at retail prices. According to a search on GoodRx, that comparison also doesn't take into account the added expense and time spent on doctor visits, while the fish antibiotics were bought over the counter. Let me drop for a second. These drugs, at least according to their labels, may not be functionally different in ingredients than the versions you get from a doctor. But because they're unregulated, there's no telling whether people are actually getting what the labels promise. And even if they're the real deal, people could still be opening themselves and others up to a bevy of added risk. Viral infections do not respond to antibiotics, and antibiotics aren't side effect free, especially if you have no idea what doses you take and for how long. Anecdotally, at least some doctors have apparently encountered patients who use fish antibiotics with dire consequences. Quote, one of my patients took a fish antibiotic because he didn't have health insurance. Farzan Navi, a New York-based emergency department physician, told The Guardian, she overdosed and ended up in an intensive care unit and ended up far more ill and having no insurance with an even bigger bill. Plus, she missed a job interview, which would have been her ticket to health insurance because of her hospital stay. So, people, leave the fish antibiotics to the little fishy. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes.
WS2N again.
Yes, Paul.
You know, well, you know, you talk about fish, big fish, little fish. I guess it doesn't matter. But I'm thinking if somebody has a lot of mass and you know, compared to another person. The doctors always prescribe these pills, you know, it might be antibiotics, pain pills, whatever it is. It always seems like it's the same size pill for everybody. I mean, does the doctors ever consider the size, you know, the mass of the person when they give them a pill? You know, everybody I know, you know, you get the Z-Pack, they're all the same, you know? So it doesn't matter how much you weigh. I don't get that. Shouldn't a bigger guy get bigger pills? Back to you, Roy.
Not really. Most dosages are not based on total mass. They're based on theoretical practical body mass, the non-fat component, because no matter how much fat that you have in your body, the medication really doesn't, for the most part, interact with the amount of fat you have. So it's lean body mass that's the most important. And in general practice, there's never been any strong demonstration of a small frame person versus a large frame person where the dosage needed to be adjusted. We do see dose adjustments are in the pediatrics, not only because children's biology works a little different than adults, but because their lean body masses can be significantly smaller than an adult. So in children, definitely you titrate dosages. In adults, usually you don't, because the range of beneficial to toxicity doesn't really require it. You can give twice as much of an antibiotic without causing any significant increase in risk. There are some medications, of course, that are titrated, not per se from a person's lean body mass or total mass, but their own biology. Different people require a different amount of thyroid extract to regulate their thyroid function, and there's a lot of different drugs that physicians need to titrate specifically for individual patients. They can't. It isn't one pill fixes all. But for antibiotics, it sort of has become that.
Okay, very interesting. You know, because I know the only pills I've come across. Well, it's all about cannabis, Tylenol, and they have, you know, the 500 milligram ones, and then they have the smaller ones. So I assume that would be for body mass. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I'm thinking. But the fat component, never thought of it. Very, very good answer. So these people that are taking fish pills, I don't get it. The fish pills must be, I mean, the fish isn't eating the pill. What are they capsules? They're opening them up and dumping them in the water? What are they doing, these things?
Yeah, that's usually the preparation. There's no dedicated preparation. There's no pharmaceutical company dedicated to your guppies. Well, what I tend to think happens is that they stock things like tetracycline used to be the kind of go-to antibiotic you would give a sick guppy. And my guess was always that these are out-of-date tetracycline pills. Legally, they couldn't possibly sell them to human beings, but because a fish store doesn't really care that it expired 3 years ago, they're usually gelatin capsules that can slide open, and you sprinkle the powder into the water, and it gives everything a rather garish yellow discoloration.
Good information and a bizarre story. Very well done. Back to you, Rick.
Indeed. Tetracycline is a somewhat pernicious antibiotic. Unfortunately, medical science learns by their mistakes, and they're human beings. Tetracycline was a decent antibiotic in its time. Almost everything is now resistant to it these days, but in its time. But the problem with tetracycline was that if you gave it to adults, you had no problem. If you gave it to children, the chemical bonds with calcium and the enamel of teeth. And there are probably still people walking around with discolored teeth due to taking tetracycline antibiotics in their childhood when their adult teeth were developing.
Very good. Okay. didn't know that. But, very interesting.
I mean, unfortunately, there's a whole bunch of vaguely similar stories. One of a great one was they discovered this anti-hypertensive medication. They gave it to a bunch of people. Then they started to have some problems with about 50% of the people that they were testing. Women would come back to the office and they would complain that they started to grow little mustaches and such. And that was minoxidil. And the beginning of minoxidil's life as a balding treatment. So to this very day, there's a whole bunch of guys who smear minoxidil on their scalp and hope for the best. It grows fine baby hairs, and as long as you keep taking it, they pretty much stay there to one degree or another. But if you can't fill your prescription for a month and you don't apply it regularly, all those little baby hairs just kind of fall out. So that was another little time when people were prescribing minoxidil to unfortunate women who really didn't enjoy the idea of hirsutism. But anyway, I digress. So let's move on to the mentor story. Seafloor mapping has revealed craters beneath the Pacific Ocean from nuclear weapons testing, scientists have reported. From 1946 to 1958, the United States dropped 23 atomic bombs over Bikini Atoll in the Pacific Ocean, including the famous Operation Crossroads and Castle Bravo tests. A team based at the University of Delaware used sonar to survey how these tests have permanently altered the islands and the seafloor in that area. A six-day journey, including a 16-hour boat ride from the Marshall Islands, brought scientists to Bikini Atoll, a group of Pacific islands made from a ring-shaped coral reef 30 miles across with a lagoon at the center. After World War II, the United States displaced residents from the Bikini Atoll in order to nuke it, sinking ships, contaminating nearby inhabited islands, and water with fallout, destroying some islands and leaving visible craters. Four researchers squeezed within a house. Persistent trade winds rocked the boat and covered the researchers in sea spray as they scanned for 3 days, returning to their home vessel each night to process the data and decide where they'd have to fill in the gaps the following day. The team focused on two of Bikini Atoll test sites from Operation Crossroads, a pair of tests the United States conducted in 1946 called Able and Baker. Able produced no visible craters, but sonar revealed that the 21-kiloton Baker test, the first ever underwater nuclear detonation, left a depression in the seafloor 800 meters across and 10 meters deep. The data revealed a landform never before seen, a mess of scraggly ripples the researchers think originated sediment settling on the seafloor after the test, and where they have remained untouched ever since. They presented their data at the press session at this year's fall meeting of the American Geophysical Union. Let me drop for a second. This exercise expands upon diving missions in the shipwrecks to the shipwrecks in the area that scientists carried out in the 1980s and the 1990s. It adds another layer to the story of the history of the early Cold War, the displacement of the atoll's residents, and the long-lasting effects of nuclear testing, more generally. Seafloor mapping, more generally, is seeing a burst of interest at present. The AGU's EOC magazine reports that 80% of the seafloor remains unmapped. The Nippon Foundation GEPCO Seabed 2030 project aims to map the entire ocean floor by 2030. These maps could be useful for weather forecasting, navigation, and other scientific pursuits, though some worry they might be exploited for sea mining enterprise. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GM. Okay, on with the next, I guess. The OSIRIS-REx team has decided on a location to collect a sample from the asteroid Bennu. It's a 460-foot-wide crater, and they've dubbed it Nightingale. OSIRIS-REx's researchers settled on the Nightingale site due to the abundance of fine-grained particles in an area where they'll be easy to collect. Dante Loretta, OSIRIS-REx principal investigator at the University of Arizona in Tucson, explained in a NASA press release the crater is largest to cross on Bennu's far northern hemisphere. The location and the relatively new age of the crater means that the material will hopefully be pristine, relatively unchanged since Bennu formed in the solar system's early days. OSIRIS-REx will not land on the site. Instead, it will approach the asteroid, touch it, grab a sample, and go in less than 5 seconds. The ship will be capable of 3 collection attempts. Bennu is a carbon-filled asteroid, 1,614 feet in diameter, orbiting the Sun at about the same distance as Earth. This orbit brings it relatively close to us, close enough that NASA scientists calculate a 1 in 2,700 chance of the asteroid striking Earth sometime between 2175 and 2199. The OSIRIS-REx mission launched in September 2016 and arrived at Bennu last December. The mission is NASA's first asteroid sample return mission, and if successful, it will bring back the largest sample of extraterrestrial material since the Apollo days. Material on carbonaceous asteroids like Bennu can serve as a record of the kind of matter present in the early solar system, and perhaps answer questions as to the origin of water and life on Earth. Let me drop for a second. Nightingale Crater isn't without hazards. The part of the crater safe for landing is only 52 feet across, and there's a big boulder on the crater's rim that might be hazardous after the sample collection, according to the NASA press release. The OSIRIS-REx team selected Osprey as a backup site in case the ship must abort its first touchdown attempt and disturb Nightingale in the process. After continuing to survey the asteroid and create high-resolution maps, the OSIRIS-REx team will plan rehearsals for its sample collection attempt. The spacecraft is due to depart Bennu in 2021 for a 2023 return to planet Earth. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Roy, that's the one with the tag unit, right? The TAG with the robotic arm on it?
That's my understanding. It's not quite the same as what was going on with the Japanese. This isn't just going to kind of grab out and do a scoop for a couple of seconds.
Okay, yeah, that's right. Okay, OSIRIS-REx has the tag then on it, the round disc, bigger than a frisbee, and it's got pressurized nitrogen behind it, and as this disc covers the area, it's going to blow it out, and then, you know, whatever particles get sucked up back into the unit itself, that's what they're going to bring back. So it's not going to land there. It's just going to reach out with its arm. So apparently they had trouble looking for a location to do this. I think Bennu was much more rocky than they thought. They thought it was going to be a lot more smooth or regular. Maybe that's why they had the problem. And they took a long time to try to figure out where they were going to do this. Very good. They finally found a spot. That's good to hear.
Yes, indeed. They found one Nightingale, and they even have a plan B, because that's what NASA does for a living. Think up plan B, plan C, plan D. So if all else fails and they don't go to the designation Nightingale, they'll go to the designated area Osprey. It's kind of fascinating. These asteroids are very, very different than most of what NASA does, because these little rocks have almost no gravitational field to speak of. When the Japanese were building little things to land on their surface, they had to really restrict their top velocity, because if they moved too quickly, they moved right off the surface of these asteroids. So I guess this takes a completely different approach, just to swipe at it and just vacuum up the stuff that that it spreads out from the swiping. So it'll be fascinating. We'll, you know, I mean, it's Japanese specimens, and we'll learn a whole bunch of new stuff.
Okay, yeah, I know. They always said if you can get the stuff into a real lab, they can learn a lot more than the bringing the lab with them. So, very good. Well, these things are amazing. I'll have to read up more about it because Bennu is rotating. That means this thing is rotating around with it. You know, it's got to be, you know, the engineering behind, the orbital mechanics behind that must be incredible.
Great. These have been particularly problematic engineering problems, both for us at NASA and the Japanese for their asteroid devices. It's a testament to engineering prowess that they were able to solve all the problems endemic in dealing with these slow little rocks flying through space.
Yeah, okay. I remember, you know, when Rosetta did it, you know, Rosetta was going around the comet, and it had a, you know, it wasn't going in a circular motion. It was strange the way it was doing it. It would change angles, you know, go one way and then come back another way, and then even with all of that, it had a lander. It sent the lander down to the surface, but not the whole big spacecraft itself. But to actually have this whole big spacecraft rotate with the asteroid is, you know, that's really something. Yeah, that's true. The Hayabusa 2 has to do the same thing. All right, back to you, Roy. Very good.
Yes, indeed. It's always fascinating to see what engineers come up to. And the gentleman mentioned you can't just kind of say it's all impossible, because I'm sure you could find wonderful examples of people in the past that said all kinds of nice things we enjoy are impossible. You know, there's a quote from Lee DeForest that television would never amount to anything. Again, you Hertz, the discoverer of radio waves, suggested that it was an interesting discovery, but of little practical value. And we've kind of made that a complete joke at this point, right? So, you know, you have to be a bit of a dreamer. But sometimes the dreamers go really far ahead of their skis, as the saying. And so they mess up bad. So it's always nice when engineers don't mess up and they're able to finesse their way into difficult problems with a brilliant little solution.
Oh, yeah. Like that, like Tesla. Tesla was another one. Which reminds me, whenever that movie comes out, I gotta see it. It came out in the movie theater, but I missed it. It's called The Current Wars, and it's the, you know, the competition between Tesla and Edison. So, you know, I mean, I've read about it 100 times, but it should be interesting in a movie. So you're saying the guy that invented the wave, the radio waves, officially it goes to Hertz, right?
According to science history, Hertz was the guy who first discovered electromagnetic radio waves, and because in his time it didn't really accomplish anything that was already being asked to accomplish. He kind of just thought it was an interesting intellectual curiosity, but probably nothing more than that.
Yeah, he didn't think about commercials. All right, back to you, Roy.
One of the problems is there were two groups of people doing this technology thing, and they were doing it from completely different perspectives with different reasons and different plans of what they were doing. There were the promoters, there were the tinkerers, there were the inventors. You had Thomas Alva Edison. You had Nikola Tesla. They were self-promoting guys. They were trying to flip these ideas into making a lot of money. On the other side, you had institutional scientists who sat around and published research papers. And although they wouldn't turn an honorarium down, that wasn't what was driving them. They weren't into particularly promoting anything or self-promoting or monetizing it. And they were just trying to answer how the hell all this stuff seems to work. So you have two major different mindsets. But you know, sometimes even the tinkerers and the inventors and the self-promoters get it wrong. Like Lee DeForest got television completely wrong when he used to talk about it before it became commercially viable.
Okay, and then after him, who was the guy? I'm trying to think of a guy's name that said, This television is going to be great. It's like we're going to have a salesman in everybody's living room. I know, of course, I know it was DeForest. He was the guy that came up with it. One of the guys. It's like, I'm trying to think of the guy's name.
But depending upon when he said it, it might be very prescient on his part. It is probably revolutionized the advertising industry. In ways we even haven't figured out. That kind of has shifted to the internet. Now the internet has kind of creeped in on all of us, and now it can fine tune ads. So depending upon how devious/clever a programmer can be, it can look at the little cookies left behind that we bit and formulate the most likely thing to try and sell you that you won't click away from. So we're almost in Brave New World category with advertising. But, you know, I think one of the major things as far as the advertising world is concerned was the ubiquity of television. I mean, you know, radio was no slouch either, but I think it kind of brought it up a couple of levels.
Oh, yeah, it certainly has. It's going to drive me nuts. I'm pretty sure that the guy, he was one of the telegraph operators that was contacting the Titanic, and then he got him involved. He started RKO. I can't think of the guy's name. It was, they had a documentary on, probably on Channel 13 one time. And that's what he came up with. He said, this is great. We're gonna have our salesman in everybody's living room. How true. What was that guy's name?
Thinking of General Sarnoff.
I said, very good. I know. I would have been searching the internet all night long. Very good.
He was a really good promoter. You know, he started in Marconi just being a telegraph operator, and somehow he just climbed that stair, and you know, he was radio. General Sarnoff. He got himself a general title from doing something with the Army around World War II, and he really loved that general title. So people were calling him General long before World War II was just a distant memory.
No, that's the guy. Very good. Okay. Yeah. Thanks for that, Brian. I'll let you continue on. WS2S.
Okay, very good. You know, General Sarnoff probably deserves a story by himself, because he was a heck of an interesting character. Anyway, astrophysicists have known for a decade that the center of the Milky Way is sending too many gamma rays our way. Mysterious stuff called dark matter was once considered the prime candidate for this excess, but subsequent data analysis implicated something more mundane. But now, a new analysis could once again swing the pendulum in favor of dark matter as an explanation. The Fermi gamma ray space satellite first measured a mysterious excess of high-energy light called gamma rays beaming in from the center of the galaxy back in 2009. Since then, mathematical models have suggested two prime candidates for the excess. They're spinning neutron stars called pulsars and colliding with dark matter, annihilating one another, where dark matter is the unidentified mass that appears to form the scaffolding of our universe. But back in 2016, two papers published in the Journal of Physical Review Letters presented two different mathematical models that seem to favor an undiscovered population of pulsars as a better fit to the data, without need to invoke dark matter and such. The dark matter hypothesis started to fall out of favor. Then, this past April, Lean and Tracy Slater, another theoretical physicist at MIT and an author on one of the 2016 papers, dropped a paper on the RxV physics paper server titled Dark Matter Strikes Back at the Galactic Center. The paper explains that the 2016 models might have been wrong. Let me drop for a second. The researchers first reviewed the non-poison template-fitting method used to calculate the various origins of light in the night sky, which treated the total light as a combination of disparate sources, each modeled by a template. All of the templates together contribute to a probability that a certain number of photons will be observed in each pixel of an image. But in their analysis on simulated data, it appears that the sum of the templates may not be correctly describing what's really going on. They demonstrate that a contribution of gamma rays from dark matter might easily be misinterpreted as coming from point sources, that is, a star-like object in the sky, most likely a pulsar. When they injected a fake signal that looked like the effect of dark matter into the real matter, the model misattributed the dark matter signal to point sources. This suggests that data are mismodeled in some way and that the dark matter may be the dominant contribution to the galactic center's excess. After all, though this does not constitute positive evidence for dark matter, the excess could still be composed mainly of point sources, the authors write in the paper, which was published in Physical Review Letters this past week. On top of that, just this past month, a separate team of scientists published a paper on the RxIV that refutes the conclusion of the second 2016 paper. In essence, this work casts doubt on the analysis previously used to attribute the excess to pulsars by demonstrating a flaw in the initial data analysis method. This back-and-forth story demonstrates that modeling space is hard and can lead to mistakes in interpretation. Now, you may have heard the saying, all models are wrong, but some are more useful. It's going to take more concrete evidence before the true identity of the source of the mysterious excess reveals itself. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on with the next. The U.S. military launched a ground-based missile this past week from Vandenberg Air Force Base, California, that landed in the Pacific Ocean. The missile had previously been banned under the Reagan-era treaty between the United States and the Soviet Union, but this was the first time that once-banned missiles have been tested. Back in August, the United States launched a new cruise missile that had already been banned under the treaty. Video released by the United States military shows the launch, which includes a ground-based missile with a range of over 310 miles. The Intermediate Range Nuclear Force Treaty, INF, had banned ground-based missiles with a range between 310 miles and 3,100 miles, strategically useful for the United States because they can be stationed in places like Eastern Europe and pointed at Russia. The United States first announced in February that it would be withdrawing from the INF Treaty, first signed in 1987, ostensibly because Russia was already violating the treaty. Quote, Russia has jeopardized the United States' security interests, and we can no longer be restricted by the treaty while Russia shamelessly violates it, the United States Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said in a press conference on February 1st, 2019. Another criticism of the INF Treaty was that China was not a party of its restrictions. The Chinese government warned back in August that new missiles tests by the United States would likely trigger a new arms race. Let me drop for a second. So The new missile began development in February and was first launched within 9 months, something that the Air Force is celebrating because the missile acquisition process typically takes 24 months. Much of the focus in United States missile development has been on the Korean Peninsula, and the American military has been staging its own tests in a seemingly coincidental tit-for-tat with North Korea, at least timing-wise. But yesterday's test was likely for Russia's benefit. As the Washington Post points out, the last remaining nuclear weapons treaty between the United States and Russia, the New START Treaty, which was signed in 2010, is set to expire in February of 2021. And the Trump administration has shown no signs of wanting to renew it. But even if that treaty is renewed, the disintegration of the INF treaty already makes the world less safe. The Pentagon declined to reveal the maximum range of the missile tested last spring when the United States officials disclosed the testing plan. They said it would be roughly about 1,860 miles to 2,480 miles. That is sufficient to reach potential targets in parts of China from a base in Guam, for example. The Pentagon has made no basing decision and has suggested that it will take at least a few years before such missiles would be ready for deployment. But the United States military insists that the new missiles make America safer. Well, the Western Range plays an integral part in testing new capabilities with our mission partners by providing the infrastructure, personnel, and range assets needed to carry out efficient missile testing from conception to evaluation, Colonel Anthony Mastell, 30th Space Wing Commander, said in statements posted online. Quote, the National Defense Strategy provides very clear direction to restore our competitive edge in the reemergence of great power competition, and we owe it to our nation to rapidly evolve and develop our capacity to defend our airmen. We should be extremely proud of their contributions to their country today. I don't know about you guys, but I certainly feel safer. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is Casey 2. Yeah. Okay, on with the next. A seemingly spontaneous conga line by a pair of captive chimpanzees might tell us something about how humans first learned to dance, scientists behind a new study said. For years, visitors to the St. Louis Zoo occasionally spotted and filmed a perplexing display from two closely bonded female chimpanzees named Holly and Bakari. They would walk and sway in sync along their habitat, usually each carrying a blanket underneath them, almost as if they were dancing a rudimentary conga line. In a new study published this past Thursday in Scientific Reports, researchers from Europe say there's ample evidence to suggest the chimp's routine was neither an accident nor the product of human training. And they even argue this discovery could help establish a new theory about how dance first evolved in humans. The researchers studied more than a dozen YouTube videos of the pair's conga line taken between 2011 and 2015. Creating a model of their movements, they concluded that the dance was an entirely purposeful ritual that the pair had well established between themselves. The chimps, they wrote, exhibited a gait movement that was individually regular and mutually synchronized, demonstrating joint rhythm keeping. Whenever one individual accelerated or decelerated her pace, a partner matched her pace. It's also unlikely that the two were ever trained to carry out their rhythmic performance by their zoo handlers, given that the practice of training chimps for entertainment had been phased out by St. Louis Zoo in the 1980s, and they had arrived close together when they were 4 months old in 1998. Nor is it likely that they would have picked up a fairly complicated behavior incidentally from watching humans, the authors said. While other animals have been observed moving their bodies rhythmically to sound during response to another member of their species, the way humans do this seems to be the first time any animals besides us have shown to display this sort of behavior spontaneously without any kind of external stimulus like music, according to the author. Let me drop for a second. In this case, it's likely that the dance arose as a coping behavior for the two chimps. While they were eventually accepted into the family at the zoo, both chimps were deprived of their mothers and a healthy environment early on in their lives, which can obviously affect both humans and non-human primates pretty dramatically. seem so closely bonded, the synchronized swing might have been a stress reliever, much like a baby sucking its thumb. Indeed, the St. Louis Zoo has said as much. The zoo's public relations director, Susan Gallagher, told local outlet KSDK in 2017 that the two chimps had been dancing since infancy. As adults, Holly and Bakari socialized with all the other members of their group and behaved like chimpanzees that they were. But there are still times when the two best friends seek each other out for the familiar tactile comfort they offer each other. But the very fact that chimps have the capacity to adopt this behavior, the study authors argue, is reason enough to suspect the origins of dance in humans might have been a multi-step process that didn't even involve music initially. And similar to Holly and Bakari, maybe it was a behavior first practiced by close-knit groups of proto-humans in stressful situations. Of course, there's only so much you can infer from about our evolution from observing our relatives in captivity, but there's a lot more work that needs to be done in untangling how and why we first learned. Okay, on to the next. CERN is expected to announce a delay to a major upgrade of the lab's Large Hadron Collider at a meeting at CERN soon. Work began on the $1.4 billion high luminosity Large Hadron Collider upgrade last year, with the revamped machine originally set to switch on in 2026. Physics World understands that a one-year delay is expected to be agreed upon so that the lab can plug a gap of about $130 million that was expected to be contributed to the High Luminosity Large Hadron Collider by non-member countries. The upgraded facility may not start until 2028 now. The High Luminosity Large Hadron Collider upgrade is designed to increase the collider's luminosity and increase it by a factor of 10 over the original machine. This requires a significant modification to the beamline along around the two largest Large Hadron Collider detectors, the ATLAS and the CMS. The work will involve upgrading about three-quarters of a mile of the 16.8-mile ring by including 11 to 12 Tesla superconducting magnets and the superconducting crab cavities that reduce the angle at which the bunches cross to increase the number of collisions at the two detectors. The upgrade also involves modifications to the Large Hadron Collider detector so that it can handle the increased luminosity. Let me drop for a second. Work on the High Luminosity Large Hadron Collider began in 2018 during Long Shutdown 2, which will last until 2021, and will see the completion of most of the civil construction for the new machine. The Large Hadron Collider will then run at 14 terravolts for 3 years before being switched off again for the components of the High Luminosity Large Hadron Collider to be installed during the Long Shutdown 3. This was due to begin in 2024 and to be completed in mid-2026, after which the High Luminosity Large Hadron Collider would have a month of commissioning before physicists begin working on it at the end of that year. However, Physics World understands that CERN will now have to contribute about $130 million more towards the upgrade, which was expected to come from other non-member countries. CERN denies this to be true, but added that it may be necessary to collect more physics data on the Large Hadron Collider, as well as extend the detector's upgrade. In this case, it may be advised to make the Large Hadron Collider run three one-year longer than the shift, the start of the long shutdown number three for the High Luminosity Large Hadron Collider to 2025. There is no delay, he said, rather an optimization of physics. So they're going to optimize their physics for a couple more years. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, I guess we have time for one more. A month or so ago, we mentioned how plant life altered our world catastrophically for non-oxygen breathers. Anaerobes, while they make way for the possibility of much more complex, more efficient burners of organic fuel our food, aerobic life was more capable of going from simple colonies of cells to organized segments to specialized organs, which could serve the organism better than simple sum of its parts. It made possible mammalian life and our own existence on this little blue marble. Plant life was first established in watery environments. In order to fully complete its revolution upon the world, it would need to find a means to survive on dry land. Recently, researchers published the genomes of two algae that are among the closest known living relatives of all land plants. They already had some of the key genes that plants would need to thrive on dry land. Intriguingly, the authors of the new study found that the forerunners of plants gained some of their ability to survive on land by grabbing genes from other species, specifically from bacteria. Already, other researchers are planning how they will use the new genomes to run experiments of their own. The paper represents a milestone for the field of early plant evolution. Plants are so important to our lives that it's hard to imagine what the world was before they existed. Until a half billion years ago, the continent was mostly bare, except for crusts of bacteria and perhaps some fungi. Once plants took root on land, they grew into forests, shrubs, lands, swamps. They built a carpet of soil, flooded the atmosphere with oxygen, and made it possible for animals to leave the sea as well. They forever changed the surface of this planet. Today, plants make up most of the world's biomass. All told, they contain about 500 billion tons of carbon, more than four times the carbon in all living things combined. After plants became widespread on land, they left behind an abundance of fossils. But the earliest chapter of plant evolution isn't well documented in the fossil record. So researchers have turned to living organisms, particularly their DNA, for hints at how land plants first evolved. Want to stop for a second? Plants capture sunlight and carbon dioxide in cellular compartments called chloroplasts. These compartments were once bacteria in the ocean. Over a billion years ago, they were gobbled up by amoeba-like organisms, and ancestors of the algae, and began to harness the power of sunlight themselves. Green algae evolved into many new forms. Some stayed in the ocean, while others moved into fresh water. Scientists have long wondered which freshwater algae gave rise to land plants and how they managed what no other lineage did. To find out, the researchers began sequencing pieces of DNA and growing family trees. At first, a group of algae called pterophytes emerged as the closest relatives of land plants. That finding seems to have made sense. For one thing, pterophytes are not single-celled organisms. Instead, they grow complex, branching bodies. They look like underwater plants. But as researchers analyzed more algae, another lineage called the zygmatophage proved to be the closest living relative to plants. That was surprising because they're much simpler than the plant-like pterophytes. They exist only as individual cells or form small, simple filaments. People knew about these algae for a long time, but they didn't think they were the closest relatives to land plants because there's an assumption that there is a linear increase in complexity, said the co-author of the new study. Researchers picked out two species of Zygmatophysia kept in algae collections in Germany to study more closely. Both species can live outside of ponds or streams. One species was scraped off of a rock in a forest in Germany. Another was found growing on moss in Portugal. The researchers sequenced the entire genome of both species and found a number of genes that the algae shared with land plants, but not with more distantly related species of algae, confirming that Zygmatophysia are the closest living relatives of land plants. Let me stop for a second. Some of these genes most likely evolved from old ones. As the ancestral algae duplicated their DNA, they made extra copies. Over millions of years, duplicates mutated into new genes that gave organisms new capabilities. But one key set of genes in Zygmatophysia arose in a radically different way. The algae seems to have stolen them from the bacteria. These genes help plants to survive droughts and other kinds of stress, even today. Survive for months or years in dormancy. The researchers found no similar versions of these genes in other algae, but they are present in bacteria, in particular in bacteria that live in soil. The algae make a spongy coat to soak up water, and some bacteria feed on the carbohydrates to make up that coat. In return, they produce vitamins that the algae may need. This intimate connection may have allowed genes from the bacteria to slip into the algae's DNA, he speculated. It's an intriguing idea, but a half billion years later, hard to test. The new genome may make it possible to figure out what exactly those plant-like genes are doing in their cells and how they evolve to take on new roles in land plants. All the new research on algae indicates that land plants did not burst on the scene in some great evolutionary leap. Instead, they built on a long preamble of adaptation in their simpler ancestors. The surface of the planet may have been green hundreds of millions of years before the first land plant. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes. Okay, very well. That's my spiel for tonight. Once again, if you have any technical questions for Dick that would land in the mailbag and can't get onto the TechNet proper, you can email them to me. If you want to have Paul aware of some article or some topic or ask him a question, you can do it through me if you would like. And if you have any questions or topics or puzzlers that I might be able to use, please feel free. I answer my email very regularly. And the best way to get to me is to just to type in your email server, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And all these articles will be available for you to peruse at your leisure, plus some interesting YouTube videos that are very informative and entertaining. They'll be available on my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. And once again, January 4th, me and Andy, WA2CDL, will be doing a two-hour stint in discussing test equipment. I hope to meet a bunch of you people down there. So I will thank Dick and Paul for the opportunity to do this, as always, and I'll be back next Sunday with some more things to talk about. So I'll turn it over to Dick so he can turn it over to Paul.
Thank you, Roy. Good stuff. We still have to figure out what kind of food to store for, say, 10 years to make sure we have a good diet afterwards. Bye-bye for now. Paul, what's going on in space? And boy, those missions where we... Why can't I think of the name of it now? You know what I mean. Yes. Progress 74.
Time complete. Boy,
we have to bring an awful lot of stuff up to maintain the International Space Station. Maintain life in space is not easy. WS2N, K2RIW, you got a call.
Okay, very good. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, yeah, Royal Progress was docked up there, but right before that, 2 days before, you had another launch, and that was by SpaceX. The Dragon cargo vehicle went up there, CRS number 19, and that successfully berthed with the space station. So you had, you know, within 2 days you had two vehicles that the astronauts had to start to unload. And again, with, you know, roughly 6,000 pounds of stuff was on the Dragon mission from SpaceX that was launched on the Falcon 9 rocket from Launch Complex 40. So between the two, you know, and you would think that's enough. That, you know, like you said before, it was, I think, three this year, sometimes four Progress missions. You have at least two or three Dragon missions per year. At least one mission from Japan the HCV vehicle docks with that, and then that brings up around 12,000 pounds per year. And then you have Cygnus. Cygnus is another American spacecraft that gets launched by the Antares rocket from Wallops Island. So you have all these